welcome everyone. You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Daphne Zohar, and my co-hosts today are Tim Oppler, Don Bell, Ethan Perlstein, and Eric Schmidt. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. Let's start by discussing the IPO market. We had a few strong offerings since the start of the year, but they tended to have mid to late stage clinical pipelines. Eric, what were your thoughts on the Metagenomi IPO and any broader implications?
Thanks, Daphne. Great to be here again. Appreciate the invitation. Yeah, rough first week for trading of Metagenomi. This is an IPO that priced last Friday at $15 a share, low end of the targeted range, and kind of immediately opened up down around $11. Not what anyone wants to see, obviously, and the stock has recovered a bit, but I think it's still trading about $12 per share today. The thing is, this isn't a bad company. They have very strong science over at Metagenomi in the field of novel nucleases for gene editing. The problem really is that platform technologies just aren't the flavor of the month in biotech, and Metagenomi is still a ways removed from, you know, even having its first IND candidate. You know, maybe if this were 2020, Metagenomi would be a $112 stock, not a $12 stock. But I think investors have just grown very wary of platform companies in today's market. What's changed? You could probably write a book about that. But the one thing that is clear is that developing drugs is really still the only tried and true way of value creation in biotech. And if you look back over the last 20 or 30 years, there have really only been a few times in the history of biotech when platforms were in favor. Those times all tend to correspond with bull markets. When capital is cheap, folks are willing to make big bets on ideas, and investors are accepting of stories that might not be tied to traditional valuation metrics. I'd say the climate in biotech is improving, and I do think we're going to see plenty of good IPOs in 2024. We've already seen a few, most recently Kyverna, also pricing last week. But this certainly isn't 2020 in terms of the biotech environment.
Yeah, I think that the ideal situation is when you have a platform and then you also have some products that are in the clinic and ideally like phase one, phase two. Tim, what are your thoughts on the IPO market more generally and preclinical IPOs?
Thank you, Daphne. I'm very aligned with Eric on this one. So, you know, weaker stories and, you know, defined weak by earlier stage or more platformy as opposed to, hey, here's a drug that could get approved, tend not to do as well. So Eric's absolutely right. You know, Kyverna has performed nicely. Aravent has performed nicely. So these are companies with very credible drug candidates that are mid-stage and also good, you know, crossover syndicates behind them. You know, not to pick on Metagenomi, they're a fine company, but, you know, they're a concept platform company going up very early in the recovery from, you know, period of inflation and Fed tightening. It just, that shoe just didn't seem to fit. The question I've been kind of asking, I'd love to hear what others think, is why did Metagenomi go out? I mean, presumably their board received advice from their bankers that, you know, hey, this might not be your best idea. So, you know, I'm very curious as to why they chose to go out in this particular market.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that Moderna, and I think Bayer is one of their shareholders. I'm not sure if they had more of that traditional syndicate, as you know. Anybody have any thoughts on that? Well, one of the areas I was looking at this week was the 13Fs. And I was wondering, so they're published, they're filed by investors within 45 days at the end of each quarter, disclosing the positions. These tend to be larger investors. I think the information is valuable in that it gives a glimpse into strategy of successful funds, including which stocks they bought and sold during the period. But the information is already outdated once it's public, and I'm not sure that a strategy of purely following these filings would be successful. So I asked, you know, Tim, have you ever seen any analysis done of this? And Tim, you found an interesting report that looked at 13Fs more broadly. And while it didn't directly answer this question, it seemed to indicate that hedge funds that use the information for contrarian bets did better than those that purely followed the trend. I didn't look deeply at the the paper that you sent me, Tim. Do you have any thoughts on that paper and also 13Fs and following those filings?
I think a lot of investors look at those 13Fs. So there's, you know, investors out there that people think are, you know, smart money, and they probably are. So, you know, I don't know if Ridgeback Capital or RA Capital or Deerfield buys a stock, you know, that's probably a signal that they've done work, and those guys have historically done very well. So if you look at the academic literature, what you see is that in general, 13F filings do not forecast future returns. You'd sort of expect that. If it were otherwise, then presumably there'd be an inefficient market that someone could exploit. What is interesting is that there are a ton of websites that allow you to track 13Fs and to see how past 13Fs sort of forecast returns. And so, you know, if you really wanted to see what RA was doing, for example, you could go to a website like whalewisdom.com and kind of, you know, research, have those past performances been predictive, and, you know, maybe make a few bets on that. My own personal view is I do think there's information content in stock selections of well-known smart investors. And I think, you know, for those of you who are listening in who are investors, it's incumbent on all of you and all of us, I suppose, to do your homework and on your own to see if you agree with that conclusion. I'd be very interested to hear what Eric has to say. Eric, you're a veteran of the markets, and maybe others have views. And I'd also love to hear just kind of in general what people are thinking of the kind of specialist investor mindset right now.
Tim, I think you're spot on. I mean, Wall Street can be a funny place sometimes, right? We're taught in school that in a perfect world, investors make their own decisions independently, and that stock prices are determined solely by the supply-demand imbalance between these buyers and sellers. But as you well know, someone who spent many years on Wall Street, for that matter, anyone who spent the day working on Wall Street knows that the community here is chock full of clicks and other social networks. And you know, after all, these are human beings that are doing the trading, and every human being on Wall Street is competitive and wants to be a leader. But there's also definitely some safety in numbers. So yeah, investors do look at who bought what and sold what over the past period. And as you've mentioned, especially look at some funds that might have had the hot hand in the recent past. One great example just this week is Bicycle Therapeutics. I don't know if this has hit anyone else's radar screen, ticker BCYC. Stock was actually up 20% on Tuesday. Why? Because the Baker brothers increased their stake to 13%. And the view is not only are the Bakers pretty savvy, but Bicycle's target, which is Nectin 4, has a lot of history with the Bakers given their prior ownership in Seattle Genetics. So yeah, generally investors do want to be in good company, maybe not too much good company, because they always want some room left for others to get in after they do. But I do think you see this group think in our industry. And, you know, for that matter, I think you see it in pharma as well, with many pharmaceutical companies going after the same target or the same area of M&A. One company gets bought and another sold shortly thereafter. Maybe some others on the call would like to comment on pharma's mentality.
I think this whole concept of following versus leading, you know, so who, this is one that goes across the industry. So this idea of pattern recognition, you know, pharma companies all sort of piling in a space that where they see others piling in. I also think that it's relevant for earlier stage investments. So, you know, some of these private investors that, you know, they spend a lot of time with the management team, which can be frustrating if they end up ultimately not following, not leading, and basically saying, oh, who's the lead and so on. Be curious to hear what Ethan and Don think about followers in general.
Well, to be honest, Daphne, I had to look up what a 13F was when you sent the list of topics out. So, but it did strike me reading about it that there is this herd mentality, for lack of a better word, amongst private investors. You see it all the time, where you you know, you're looking to get a syndicate together, and everyone's like, oh, well, you know, you need a lead, and then the lead, you know, theoretically does the heavy lifting on the diligence, and then other people come in and sort of, you know, invest on their endorsement, if you will, the social proof. And, you know, we have that kind of social proof and just, you know, probably outside of biotech too. I think we see it. It's a part of being human, as Eric mentioned. And just a comment on the pharma mentality. I mean, I think that when you think about the what drives incentives and, you know, I look at decision making through an incentive lens, especially in large bureaucracies, and that you will you basically won't get killed if you make a decision that the herd is making and it goes wrong. Whereas if you make a contrarian decision and it doesn't go well, then you're going to get killed. And so I think that there's another reinforcement of sort of that herd mentality in pharma.
Yeah, I totally agree. I also just sort of say that, at least for my neck of the woods, you know, there's a slow rise in what I'm calling the investor operator. It's a common concept in tech that if you kind of advance far enough in your sort of founder career, you become an investor. And then, of course, you're going to, you know, be someone who understands very clearly what it's like to, you know, have to chase after a lead or get an anchor investor. And so I think hopefully over time, we're going to see more successful founders exit and become investors themselves and sort of be non-institutionals. And then if you can get groups of these sort of, you know, founder operator investors to syndicate rounds, maybe the dynamics will start to change and you don't have to sort of pursue this this mythical lead investor.
Just to jump in and make a comment, Eric, your point about clicks and Don, your point about, you know, herd behavior and so on, it's so relevant. One of my favorite kind of historical academic figures is Margaret Mead. She wrote a book called Coming of Age in Samoa in 1928. It could have been written today if you talk to any teenagers. The book kind of talks about cruelty between adolescent females and how cruel they can be to each other. And, you know, what happens is people are competing for relevance in, I guess they don't have high school in Samoa in 1928, but, you know, whatever they did. And today you hear about this in high schools all the time. And there's even a famous movie called Heathers about the behavior of, you know, these young girls towards each other. They're essentially competing for status. So we see the same thing in our sector all the time, right? People are competing for status. And to some degree, you know, Biotech Hangout is all about, like, hey, you don't have to compete for status to be an insider in this industry. Just join Biotech Hangout. We'll tell you what's going on. And similarly, you know, when I watch these investors, there are some that are willing to be contrarian, but overwhelmingly, people do tend to herd in our industry. And I think it's deep-seated social behavior.
Yeah, I like this idea of specialist investors as the mean girls of biotech. So,
I mean, you heard Peter Kolchinsky's comment was 2 months ago. He's like, yeah. I'd like to have no generalist investors in the market. I thought that was so interesting. And, yeah. You know, he defines who those specialist investors are and who's relevant. And I mean, I'm not calling Peter Kolchinsky, you know, a teenage girl. He's actually a very, you know, mature, well, non-girl person. But you get my point, which is these social dynamics play out in all human activity, and they're certainly playing out in our sector every day.
Yeah, it's actually very interesting because the way that a lot of companies end up, you know, sort of being public is they initially get some of these top tier Series A investors that are the leads that others follow. And then they get the top tier crossover investors. And then they get the top tier, you know, long-term investors like T. Rowe and Capital and, you know, others. And it there is this sort of, you know, I think click or whatever, this group that others tend to look to. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with past track record, but I think it's a really fascinating topic. So we had more M&A this week. Eric, were you following the $4.3 billion Gilead Sema Bay acquisition, and what were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, Daphne, I don't cover any of these stocks, but you're 100% right. Another week, another acquisition. Gilead paying, a 26% premium to Sema Bay's last trade. And I think in Wall Street circles, this one wasn't too surprising. You know, from Sema Bay's standpoint, the company actually did a pretty nice job bringing their drug, Seladelpar, to the cusp of FDA approval for primary biliary cholangitis, or PBC. And the drug actually has a PDUFA date of August 14th. Selendipar's biggest differentiating attribute is that it's been shown to have a benefit of reducing pruritus or itching, and that's actually a big deal. It's one of the hallmarks of the disease. And my colleague here at Cantor, who covers CymaBay, has a great call on this name and thinks it's going to be, quite a successful product, maybe even a billion-dollar drug. What's kind of amazing here is this was just a $4 stock 15 months ago. So the $32.50 acquisition price caps off a very nice run for them. From Gilead's standpoint, they've been talking about doing a meaningful acquisition every 2 years or so, and it's been right about 2 years since their last one. So also no surprise, and no surprise that this deal comes in the field of liver disease, where they've got a major commercial presence. Sounds like they are taking on some regulatory approval risk, but much like we've seen before with MorphoSys and Karuna, before that one, these PDUFA dates, that they may not be as concerning as we might think for acquirers, or maybe as concerning as they used to be. I think years ago, folks were very leery about stepping in front of a PDUFA date. So I guess one of the things that we've been hearing is why CymaBay and not Madrigal. Madrigal is a similar-sized liver disease company. It operates in the MASH-NASH market with a huge potential commercial opportunity in front of it, and also a PDUFA date. I think it's actually just next month. So could be that Gilead prefers a narrower specialty market. Maybe folks are worried about the disruptive potential of GLPs for the NASH indication, or maybe Madrigal's next. We've been talking about follow the leader. It would be quite ironic if this might be the next takeout candidate. Maybe Dawn, you have some thoughts here?
Yeah, I'm actually a little bit surprised. There's not more M&A buzz around Madrigal, but these endpoints in NASH, these fibrosis endpoints, are historically been very challenging. And I looked at these data recently published in New England Journal of Medicine, and I have to say, they are stellar. I mean, I think this is the first time I've seen a product hit on both of the endpoints that the FDA has designated as surrogates for potential approval. And the safety profile is remarkable. So a little GI nausea side effects, but what you're really concerned about is the metabolic side effects, and lipids are down. There's no a hint of diabetic hyperglycemia or anything like that, like we saw with obeticholic acid, which ultimately never got approved for NASH, as we know. So I think it's maybe next. I would think so. I think there's a big misperception that the GLP-1s are going to take over this NASH and sort of like prevent NASH from ever happening. Neither tirzepatide nor semaglutide have shown any improvement in fibrosis, although they do reduce liver fat and inflammation nicely. But not everyone's going to be saved by GLP-1s. There are going to be these patients that have progression to F2, F3, F4, which is a terrible staging for the fibrosis, and they're going to need drugs like this that can actually improve that fibrosis score and improve the histologic findings. So, really great data. Congratulations to Madrigal, and yeah, we'll look forward to seeing who snaps them up next. I'm curious, Eric, what you think though the premium should be on Madrigal. So they're trading nicely up on the data. I think yesterday I looked at it as maybe a $4.5 billion market cap. To get taken out, what do you think it would take, so to speak?
Well, that's a good question. One of the funds we just referenced, Baker Brothers, is of course a major investor, and they don't have a track record of selling out for cheap. And I can also imagine that there's probably a fair bit of optimism for the upcoming launch in NASH, which that launch obviously comes with some risk, but there could be an opportunity to reset valuation if it goes well. Tim, you're the banker.
I mean, I've been in pitches for Madrigal with Big Pharma, just to point out a few things to consider when one looks at, why has this company not been bought? My understanding is that the composition of matter patent on the chemical matter is a 2026 expiration. So you essentially launch and you're looking at potential Paragraph IVs in 3 years. They have a thicket, as you would imagine, of other patents. The other thing to note, and we talked a little bit about this last week when we were talking about, what does liver fat mean, is the THR beta mechanism is not one that directly impacts the laydown of collagen from stellate cells in liver, right? It's an indirect antifibrotic that works through the control of liver fat deposition. And so it's just not obvious to me that this is kind of what Big Pharma is looking for. Now, I'm wrong all the time. For all I know, tomorrow morning, Madrigal gets bought for a 100% premium, but I wouldn't bet on it.
You know, one thing you mentioned, this is Eric again, is patents. And we actually did an analysis published just this week, so very timely, looking at the patent life of all of the deals over the last five or so years that have been done in our space. And Tim, you're 100% right. There is a very much a sweet spot for IP, composition of matter IP, where the great majority of lead products that were acquired by Big Pharma have a 14 to 15 year lead time to first composition of matter patent expiration. So it's certainly possible that Madrigal's in a different space and that folks are not comfortable with that.
I frequently look at the, you know, chatter on Twitter and, you know, people be like, I think this one's going to get bought tomorrow. What I always think is funny is people don't even name the stock. They just say MDGL, bought tomorrow or something like that. It's like, do these people know what a patent is? I mean, you got to analyze patents if you're going to predict what pharma's going to buy.
Yeah, that's a great insight, Tim. Yeah, thanks for that.
Eric, it would be great if you could share that analysis and we'll share it through Biotech Hangout. It's really intriguing. So there were a few offerings this week and some related data. Eric, can you discuss Larimar and Prime, and then Tim can do Sana and CRISPR?
Yeah, so Larimar, interesting result. They have a candidate. It's called CTI-1601. It's got a new name that I think is too difficult for at least me to pronounce, but they're operating in the field of Friedreich's ataxia. And as many investors will know, Friedreich's ataxia is an indication that was really put on the map by Biogen and Reata. Reata developed a drug, Skyclarys, and Biogen acquired Reata last year. And Skyclarys was the first and still only drug to be approved in this indication. Very severe indication, affects folks really in the middle or prime of their life. And it's characterized by a deficiency in the protein Fraxin. And it's exactly that Fraxin protein that the folks at Larimar are looking to restore into cells. They've created a way of bringing Fraxin into the through the cell membrane by linking it to a cell penetrating peptide. It's interesting technology, certainly unproven, certainly complex. The data that they presented this week were very well received by investors, essentially a proof of concept phase one study where they are showing in the skin and the buccal cavity, mouth, that they're able to get greater expression of the protein through this methodology, this approach. I still think there's a fair bit of risk here because we have no real understanding that the protein is active and there's no functional benefits that they've been able to show on top of the biomarker data they have. So I'd say they still have a good bit of progress to make before this is convincing. They're hopeful actually to get FDA approval based on biomarker only data. I think that might be a little bit of a stretch, but stock was very well received on these news. It was up about 100% this week, and it's only about a $500 million company. Biogen, of course, paid many billions. I think it was $7 billion for Reata. So if this is indeed the real deal, could be very interesting. And then Prime, I think you also asked me to talk about Daphne. That's interesting for a very different reason, which I think is the financing they were able to pull off. And we can probably talk about that after Tim addresses some of the other data points in the space.
And to comment on the other two names that you mentioned, Daphne, you know, Sana, I think, is known for being excellent engineers of allogeneic cells, particularly in an ex vivo setting. And their innovation is the ability to essentially remove our body's immune response to those cells, their so-called hypoimmune platform. So they've actually been starting to have some data. They've got an IND out there. They're working on CAR T cells for cancer. And now they have this hypoimmune approach for type 1 diabetes, which, you know, is super relevant given the progress, say, for example, that Vertex has made in type 1 diabetes with cell therapies. And so the company is in a position, given the improving market, to go out and raise money, and that they did. And I think hats off to their team for what they've accomplished. CRISPR Therapeutics is a more advanced company. Of course, they are, you know, the home of the recent sickle cell approval that was achieved by Vertex. So that's quite the accomplishment. But what's impressive about CRISPR is actually how deep their pipeline is. They have a deep pipeline in autoimmunity, immuno-oncology, and also cardiovascular disease. And so they've got clinical, you know, data that's either out or coming out for things like ANGPTL3, Lp(a), and of course, a host of oncology and autoimmune targets. And so they did not struggle to get money raised this week in the, you know, very hot secondary market.
And if I could tag on to Tim, I mean, I think the common thread across these financings, Prime, which was also able to raise, I think, a little over $150 million, and Sana and CRISPR that Tim covered, the common thread here is that these are all cell therapy gene editing stocks. And as we all know, they've been some of the weakest performers in the group over the last 12 months. There's been huge financing pressure and overhang on all of these companies, many of which have substantial burns. And yet this week, not only were all three able to raise money, but all three are performing quite well in the aftermarket. I think if you look between the three, they're averaging 20%+ outperformance since their deals were priced. So that's just a really welcome sign in the gene editing, gene therapy, cell therapy space. And one thing we haven't seen in a long time. I also want to just give a quick shout out to CRISPR in particular. They've just done a terrific job throughout the market's ups and downs of maintaining a really healthy balance sheet. I think they've been able to differentiate themselves from other gene and cell therapy companies in the space because of just how much capital they have, still over $2 billion. And you can see from their valuation versus many of their peers that strong balance sheet has translated into, you know, very strong stock performance. So, you know, kudos to CRISPR CEO Sam Kulkarni for being able to navigate those financings.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. And there was one other offering this week, and also data. And I guess both Eric and Tim can't comment because Cantor and Stifel were involved in the offering. Don, let's discuss Calvista.
Sure, yeah. So this is and it results of their HAE study with sebralchrostat. So the confidence study looked at the treatment of acute attacks of hereditary angioedema. And this was actually the largest acute HAE trial to date, 136 patients enrolled in 66 sites across 20 countries. And I say all that because I think it's important to understand the complexity of the execution of these clinical trials. Even when it's a rare disease with, you know, relatively small number of patients, it's still a very complex thing to execute. And this would be the first oral therapy, if approved, for acute attacks of hereditary angioedema. There is an oral prophylaxis therapy approved, Betralastat by BioCryst, but this is looking at patients who may or may not be on long-term preventative therapy who have acute attacks. And the confidence study met all their primary and key secondary endpoints, showing significantly faster symptom relief and faster time to complete attack resolution, along with a very benign safety profile. And I'm not an HAE expert, but this looks to be excellent data for acute HAE. Now, the HAE market has been shifting away from treatment of acute attacks to prophylaxis over the past few years, but as I mentioned, there were about 20% of patients or so that were on long-term prophylaxis in this trial, and they seem to benefit similarly in terms of the time to resolution of attacks that they experience. So we know that prophylaxis doesn't reduce these attacks to zero, and they are very disruptive. I know I have a good family friend who her and her three children all have hereditary angioedema, unfortunately, and it is very disruptive, and the improvements that we've seen in the treatment of this disease has been great, but to have an oral therapy, another oral therapy to address acute attacks, I think is a wonderful addition to the armamentarium.
And it's good to see the healthy follow-on market continuing. One area we've been following on Hangout is companies that trade at a negative EV, particularly post-negative data, and ways that the cash could end up benefiting investors. Of course, there are reverse mergers, which have been very much sought after over the last couple of years. We've heard of reverse merger targets having 25 to even as many as 150 proposals. One thing we haven't seen a lot of is companies winding down and returning capital to shareholders. And there were two of those this week. So we had Merrimack Pharmaceuticals announcing that the FDA has approved Ipsen's new first-line medication for pancreatic cancer, which triggered a $225 million milestone payment from Ipsen to Merrimack. Following the FDA approval, Merrimack's board will ask for approval of corporate dissolution together with a distribution of that milestone payment to shareholders. And in 2019, Merrimack restructured and cut all of its employees, including management, basically existed as a shell in order to pay out this milestone. So that was interesting. And then someone who's been aggressively pursuing the model of acquiring companies for their cash is Kevin Tang. So if you'll remember, in December, Tang Capital's Concerta proposed to acquire Leon Bio in a cash deal for $4.30 per share, which would have given Concerta 80% of net proceeds on any U.S. and China-based programs. Leon Bio turned down the acquisition offer, and which the board viewed as undervaluing the company, and then shortly after that, the CEO and CFO left the company. This week, Leon Bio announced that the company is winding down, and the board declared a special cash dividend of $528 million, or $4.80 per ordinary share. So two things. One, Tim, do you have any thoughts on the Tang strategy more broadly and Leon's board decisions? And then, Eric, I'd love to have you comment on the continued sanctions against China biotechs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, frankly, welcome news to see companies that, you know, want to return cash to shareholders, even if they don't have a good M&A outcome, right? I mean, we should see that happen a lot more. People tend to avoid that, even when they kind of hit the end of the road. So hats off. You know, you would wish in kind of a funny way that you didn't have to have Kevin Tang or someone like him come along to force that dissolution. He's essentially getting almost like a banker fee. In other words, he's not paying, you know, 100 cents on the dollar for the cash he's buying in Leon Bio, right? He's getting it at a bit of a discount to provide the service of shutting down the company. So, you know, in theory, one would hope that the board could do that themselves. For various reasons, the lawyers tend to counsel against that. And that's more related to, you know, potential tail liability risk and so on. But, you know, my own view is we ought to be able to figure our way through that. So, good to see.
I think they chose to do in this case, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. Right. Under pressure, and then, I mean, Merrimack is kind of a textbook case of what you should do, right? So, they essentially turned into a company with just tail payments, and so they said, okay, let's wait till we get the last tail payment. They got it. Now they're going to liquidate, and that's kind of what theory would say you should do in that situation.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that this is welcome, and it seems like, you know, you just don't see the strategy playing out as much. Companies tend to sort of spend down the cash and or do the reverse merger outcome. So, Eric, did you want to talk about Leon Bio and with the perspective of these sanctions against China biotech?
Yeah, I mean, I guess unfortunately, Leon's fate seemed to be sealed now for some months and years, as you and Tim just kind of mapped out. I mean, for those of you less familiar with this company, they were set up a few years back, like several other companies, really with the goal of in-licensing drugs that were being developed and hopefully approved in the U.S., bringing those drugs to China and becoming a marketing arm for U.S. biotech companies. That business model really fell on tough times a couple years ago, in large part owing to the local price controls in China on pharmaceuticals that just made China a much less attractive market. And certainly Leon was a victory of that change. And then, you know, over the last 6 months or so, to add insult to injury, this very icy U.S.-China political relations has been weighing very heavily on China biotech. We saw just this week several congressmen go after WuXi AppTec and WuXi Biologics, saying that, in effect, these companies are closely tied to the Communist Party in China and that they have received military funding from that party and that we shouldn't be doing any business and that there should be further sanctions against WuXi AppTec and WuXi Biologics. So all quite messy right now, especially considering that, you know, the U.S. government is also thinking about banning China companies from receiving U.S. contracts and There have been some discussions also about delisting such companies in the U.S. So it's tough times right now, choppy waters for China biotech in the States.
Yeah. So, Don, were you tracking CSL's phase 3 trial?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one. This is another example of, you know, continued search for novel biologic agents in cardiovascular diseases. Remember back in November at AHA, we had so many abstracts of new and exciting agents across modalities, including gene therapy and siRNA, as well as biologics. And I'd love to see that kind of momentum and innovation aimed, you know, at the world's number one killer, which, as you all know, is kind of my specialty area. Unfortunately, not a happy ending here. So this was the results, just top level, the AEGIS II study of CSL112, which is a human plasma-derived apolipoprotein A1, which is basically the business end of good cholesterol. So its job is to suck cholesterol out of your arteries and take it to the liver for processing. And so this was a cardiovascular outcomes trial, enrolled over 18,000 patients, 850 sites, 49 countries, really complex study to do, and it was done well, I might add. And these patients had had a recent heart attack and were at high risk for another heart attack or a cardiovascular event over the next 90 days. Now, we don't know a lot from the press release, but what we do know is that the study did not meet its primary endpoint, which was a 20% reduction in major cardiovascular events at 90 days. There were no safety issues during the trial. We also know that at some point during the trial, there was a protocol amendment that changed the enrollment criteria of the patients to a higher risk profile because the pooled event rate was tracking lower than expected. That's a very common thing we do in outcomes trials, look at this pooled event rate. And so enrollment was increased from the original projection of around 17,000 to a little over 18,000. But apparently that wasn't enough. There were two interim analyses for futility, which is also common in these studies. And the study was not stopped early for futility. So I expect when we see the full results that we're going to see some effect size here, but just probably not enough to meet that 20% threshold that was set by the power analysis. And that 20% reduction in events is widely considered what is clinically important to meet. So we'll probably see some effect, but not to that level. And I have to say that, you know, CSL had the classiest quote in their press release that they were proud. That was the most ambitious study that they had done in their company's history. And they were proud of the quality of the study and the capabilities that they built to execute it, and that they'll put those capabilities to good use in the rest of their portfolio. So I thought that was a really, really classy response, because this is an ambitious study for any company, and not one that... the size of the study was really quite different from CSL, what they normally do, which they tend to be smaller populations in rare diseases. So we'll continue to learn more about this important pathway when the full results are presented at the American College of Cardiology in April. But congratulations to CSL for, you know, conducting a very ambitious and challenging study.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a good point that when management runs, you know, a study, a well-run study, gets an answer and is transparent and does a great job communicating the results, that should be a win, because that's really, you know, what we're all trying to do here, and not everything is going to succeed. So I think, you know, I agree with what you're saying in terms of applauding CSL for both the transparency and also running a study that, you know, where people can learn something and make decisions. You know, speaking of cardiovascular, you know, broadly, Alnylam has been in the news a lot this week. And in particular, there was interest in their decision to change the stat plan on Helios-B. I'm curious to hear from both Eric and Don what you thought about that.
Go ahead, Don.
Sure. I mean, I think it's, it was interesting. I was listening to the STAT podcast yesterday, and they were sort of lambasting. That's never a good thing when this happens. But, you know, the goalposts on in this disease have been changing as the treatment paradigms have been changing. And so I think in any kind of, you know, outcomes trial like this, that you do want to monitor a pooled event rate and make adjustments, in your statistical analysis plan. It's not uncommon to do in the cardiovascular outcomes world. So, you know, is it possible it doesn't bode well? Yes. Is it possible that it could be what is needed to get the answer that you're, to make sure you're getting the answer you're asking? you know, I think it's better than seeing trends in your pooled event rate and not making adjustments to your statistical analysis plan.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's a tough one. And it's hard to know exactly what to think. Obviously, something changed, right? And investors don't like change. And with change comes uncertainty. If the trial were proceeding as we all thought it was, or as Alnylam expected it to do so, this change would not have been required. And I think the news yesterday that they're going to tweak the endpoint a little bit and extend the study by another 3 months, you know, that comes with a lot of uncertainty. The strange thing to me, and I'm not the primary analyst on Alnylam, and I don't cover other companies in the ATTR cardiomyopathy space, but it's kind of amazing how little we know about this disease. And of course, we got the first ever therapy, tafamidis, approved just about 5 years or so ago. But this, prior to tafamidis' approval, had been really an unknown area of medicine. It was once thought to be an extremely rare disease. It turns out it's much, much more common. And even the experts who opine on this space, the folks that Wall Street uses to give us some guidance, are kind of all over the map on whether these stabilizers are going to be acceptable versus some of the degraders that are being developed. So it's kind of the Wild West biologically right now and medically, and probably that's why this change was required, and we'll have to see how it all plays out. I do think there's risk, and I think it could end poorly or well for Alnylam.
Thank you. There were a couple of private financing mega rounds that drew attention this week. BioAge raised $170 million. And I think the whole idea of this next generation group of companies tackling muscle mass loss with GLP-1 therapy, and just in general, kind of like the next wave of obesity-related meds, is pretty interesting. Ethan, you've been following BioAge for a while. I'd love to get your thoughts and then have Don weigh in.
Yeah, super excited to share this announcement on behalf of BioAge. So they had a press release early this week announcing $170 million oversubscribed Series D financing that will accelerate development of their obesity and metabolic disease therapeutics. Specifically, the funding will be allocated to advance phase two clinical trials of BioAge's lead asset, a molecule called azelaprag, which is an apelin receptor agonist. And as Daphne said, it will be tested in combination with Lilly's Zepbound or tirzepatide. And I think that's obviously very exciting. And azelaprag was already sort of being tested as a monotherapy in the context of sarcopenia or muscle loss in the elderly that are bedridden. So this is really exciting to see this combination space open up between GLP-1s and these other potential mechanisms for decreasing body weight and increasing or changing body composition in a more favorable way metabolically. James Healy, managing partner at Sofinnova Investments, which led the round, was appointed chairman of the board. I think there's, you know, multiple notable aspects of this story. I think first off, longevity biotech in general, I think, is now officially mainstream. It's no longer billionaires bilking blood boys or unsavory cults of personality and just sort of, you know, fringe ideas. This is now mainstream biotech. So I think that's this is sort of a good moment to recognize that. And I also think it's an important moment to recognize that this is a new generation of biotech founders coming up. This is, you know, frankly, my generation. BioAge was started in 2015. Kristen Fortney, a co-founder of BioAge, had never run a biotech before. And yet here she is, still, by the way, CEO. You often see as a company progresses through its financing life cycle that the founding scientist CEO sometimes meets a graceful exit or sometimes ungraceful exit. But in this case, I think must be a huge vote of confidence from very stellar investors, you know, including OrbiMed, SV Health Investors, Cormorant, many others, RA Capital. A huge vote of confidence in Kristen as a first-time scientist founder CEO who's, you know, trailblazing into the clinic. And so didn't need to step aside for a quote-unquote professional to take over. So I think longevity biotech's here, so-called founder-led biotech is here and is here to stay. And Dawn, I'd love to hear your perspectives.
Thanks, Ethan. Congratulations to Dr. Fortney and her growth and the growth of BioAge. It is really fantastic to see this. They caught my eye when their phase 1b study was released, their data from that. This was the most elegant clever study that I can remember seeing in recent memory. So what they did is that they actually had healthy volunteers over the age of 65 that went on strict bed rest for 10 days and were randomized to placebo or to their apelin agonist. And the stunning amount of muscle loss patients over healthy volunteers, right? So these aren't even sick people over the age of 65 by just doing nothing for 10 days was staggering to me. And then, their medicine was able to ameliorate some of that muscle loss. And I think that this just is a great testament to the importance of metabolic health and aging. But I think also I hear what you're saying about longevity medicine being mainstream, but I think this also looks to me a little bit like a pivot and a focus to a metabolic health indication. And I think that is was the right thing to do in this company, because, you know, the most tweetable quote of the hangout today, in my opinion, was developing drugs is the only tried and true way to create value in biotech. And that's exactly what's happening here, right? So there was a platform, there was an asset, you know, pivot to focus on the asset in a really interesting application and with a very elegant clinical development program. And I might add collaboration with Eli Lilly's Chorus program for their phase two. So I think that's, along with the financing, also a fantastic collaboration to, help to get the most success out of this asset that's possible. So, you know, good luck to BioAge and congratulations on the financing.
Yeah, I think that it was, you know, a bit of a pivot, and I also would like to agree with what Ethan was saying about founder-led companies, and I think that there's a certain vision and passion of a company that's led by a founder, which, I think is recognized. I mean, there is sometimes this perception around, you know, VCs funding a company and then, you know, as the company grows, thinking you need to bring in sort of later stage type of management, but it does seem to be situations, you know, specific. So there's, a number of very, you know, good examples of founder-led companies that, you know, for example, like Alnylam up until a few years ago, or that was it like 2 years ago that John stepped down. So yeah, founder-led biotechs, I'm for them. And then there was another big financing private company that was in the news this week, Latigo, with their non-opioid pain medicine story, particularly on the back of Vertex's recent progress in the area. I'm curious to hear from Eric and Tim, any thoughts on Latigo?
Yeah, this is another interesting one. It's kind of also consistent with the theme that there's a little bit of a follow the leader thing going on here in biotech. And you could throw BioAge in that too. I think the reason that BioAge's financing was so successful was because of the success that the GLP-1s are having in obesity and metabolic disease. And obviously investors want more, and BioAge has a brand new mechanism, fascinating mechanism, by the way, this apelin pathway stuff that Dawn was referencing. But because of the success of GLP-1s, I'm sure BioAge was able to raise that kind of capital, and certainly to some extent following on Lilly's coattails, especially given they're gonna be co-developing the product with Lilly. In terms of Latigo, it's Vertex that we're latching on to in terms of coattails. Latigo launched $135 million, or actually I think completed $130 million transaction this week. And they are going after a target called NaV1.8, sodium channel inhibitor. And that of course is the same target as Vertex's 548 drug that just succeeded in a pivotal study in pain. So the success, I'm sure, of the Vertex candidate and a lot of investor interest and enthusiasm for having a new non-opioid pain medication available had to have played a big role in Latigo's ability to gain that substantial funding via the financing. But Tim, do you see it as I do, or do you think they're going after a new pathway here?
Oh, no, I think Latigo is definitely jumping on those NaV1.8 coattails, and probably will end up being a good bet. Fast follower strategies have historically paid off well in our industry. I mean, to me, kind of the question is just how good is the Vertex drug going to be? It clearly is nice in the sense that it gives physicians another option for patients that should not be on opioids. But I was kind of hoping that, you know, we'd see this drug like beat Vicodin, not just match Vicodin, or, you know, clobber some of the other drugs that are out there. And so I do think there will be an opportunity for Latigo. I will make a comment on BioAge Labs. I think it's really interesting company, and obviously a super impressive group of investors that came together there. But, you know, there's this sort of story going around our industry that we need to augment muscle for people that are on these weight loss drugs. And there is a lot of evidence that would support that. But I just want to highlight that if you go talk to, you know, experts in obesity and nutrition in the academic setting, and I've had some of those conversations, they make some just really obvious points that I'm not sure we've all thought about. And the point goes something like this. If you weigh 200 pounds and then you go on your semaglutide and now you weigh 150 pounds, you probably should lose some muscle, right? The body at 150 pounds doesn't need the same amount of muscle. So it's only like excess muscle loss that one would worry about. And I haven't seen the data yet that would suggest that the current crop of GLP-1s is leading to excess muscle loss. And so, you know, all of a sudden, gosh, there must be a dozen companies, you know, that are chasing, you know, muscle. And I'm not sure that there's going to be that much room in the armamentarium for those companies. I'd love to hear what others think about this.
Yeah, Tim, I think you're right that it is a controversial topic, one that Lilly seems to be convinced by, right, with the Versanis acquisition and now this collaboration with BioAge. But I'm not sure everyone is convinced, to your point. And certainly, you know, some of the I think, you know, other strategics maybe are wanting to hedge their bets on this. But as you say, some experts in academia and elsewhere are not so convinced that this is a big problem.
And, you know, what's so tricky is, you know, these VCs, they're looking for a story that they can sell, right? So that's sort of what we're talking about here. You can sell NAV1.8, you can sell the muscle loss story. I guess I'm just sort of saying, you know, when these drugs get to the market, is there really going to be a big market for a muscle-preserving drug? I actually really like the idea of using a muscle-preserving drug to treat people that are aging, right? We know that sarcopenia is a hallmark of aging, and it can be devastating for an aging person.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's probably the number one reason that people lose their independence, right? This is the consequences of sarcopenia when they can't lose their mobility and can't stay in their home. I think that, you know, the combination therapy with a lower dose of tirzepatide, which may be better tolerated, and then the apelin agonists to have sort of comparable weight loss to higher dose tirzepatide with better body composition as a bonus, you know, it's a harder story to tell, but that may be the real value proposition here.
So we're almost at time. We have a few minutes left to go around and make any closing remarks or thoughts. And I think, Dawn, you also wanted to talk about employee drug benefits. So I'll let you go first, and then we'll go around the room.
Well, it's just, to me, it's just kind of a funny story that I just want to put on people's radar to watch if anything comes of it. So the J&J is the subject of a class action lawsuit, sort of in an interesting twist on the PBM middleman saga. In this situation, J&J is being sued not as a drug manufacturer, but as an employer. The suit alleging that they basically neglected their fiduciary duties and mismanaged their prescription drug benefits program, costing their employees millions of dollars. So that allowing their PBM to overcharge, if you will, not doing their due diligence on that, and passing those costs along to the employees. So this is up for, you know, J&J has filed for a motion to dismiss. And if it doesn't get dismissed, it could get really interesting with the PBMs being drawn into it and potentially the benefit management consultants that, you know, that advise employers on which PBMs to choose. And there may be some backhand dealings allegedly between those consultants and the PBMs on who gets the contract. So it's a bit of intrigue and corruption allegedly that could be uncovered. And so, you know, we'll see if this ends up in court, and you know, we can watch popcorn as it unfolds. Eat popcorn, excuse me, as it unfolds.
Thank you. Ethan, do you have any remarks as we're closing out the room?
Yeah, just don't sleep on founder-led biotech. There's a whole crop of companies that were started, that Perlara fits in that bill, 2014 vintage. We have a phase three trial now. You have BioAge, you have Shosky. There's a whole number of companies of that generation that are in the clinic that may, some have been profiled, some have gotten more press than others, but don't sleep on founder-led biotech and just keep your eyes peeled on these big rounds coming and the founders still remaining at the helm as CEOs.
Yeah, these big private rounds, I think, are kind of a bullish sign with regard to how private investors are viewing the market uptick. So that's positive. Tim?
Just to end where we began on kind of the market, as we, sit here talking on Friday afternoon, the XBI is as high as it's been in over 2 years. So we've seen inflation news that hasn't been great the last few weeks. And this market is moving and it's moving up and there's a lot of money flowing in. We're seeing an active secondary market. I think it's a very positive time for our sector. And, the underlying fundamentals that we've touched on in so many ways today are there. And that fundamental is innovation, and innovation is just not stopping.
Thanks, Tim. Eric, it's been a pleasure having you on. I think after you're on here twice, you kind of get sucked into this group and you end up coming back more. So hopefully you'll be open to it.
I can't think of a better group than this to get sucked into, Daphne. Thanks for having me.
Silence.
All right. Well, I think this has been a great discussion. I particularly like the concept of, thinking about the biotech industry and the sort of the kingmakers or the mean girls, as we want to call them, but sort of bless these new ideas and having followers follow. But I think that it's an interesting dynamic, and what I'm encouraged by is just the healthiness of the follow-on market, and the fact that the IPOs IPOs are getting out, preclinical ones not so successful, but in general, IPOs with clinical stage compounds with or without a platform, I think are doing quite well. And that's a very positive sign for the sector. So I thank everyone for joining us here today. Oh, I have one question actually from the audience that I wanted to refer to you. I think it's to Eric and Tim. This is a question from Leon Tang. What's your advice to Chinese biotech to navigate the choppy water? To my best knowledge, the BD out-licensing deals from China to the West and China-Europe deals seem to be doing really well. This is from Leon Tang.
Yeah, no, thank you, Leon. It's a great question. And in the same sense that, U.S. biotech's just been through hell and now hell and back, it's just happening to China now. And it's, very, very tough time because there's been a lot of investment in biotech in China. The market has shifted for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, but Chinese market's been really weak lately, maybe even panic type selling, very much akin to what we saw in 2022 in our market in the US. And same advice applies, buckle down, be very careful with your budgets, try to do BD, try to be very smart about how you allocate resources, don't have too many projects. All of those things that, we've just been through in America and Europe are very applicable at the moment in China. I will say the one thing that's maybe a little bit unfair about my comments is I think Chinese biotechs are kind of more efficient to begin with. And so we may see some Chinese biotech companies that are not innovative enough go away in this market.
I just add on to that. While Leon's model of taking technology from the U.S. and bringing it into China, that seems today to be a bit of a flawed model given the Chinese pricing environment, the opposite direction of taking technology out of China and bringing it into the U.S. is alive and well, in my opinion. And certainly, Chinese biotechs are not immune to the capital markets, as Tim just referenced, but we are seeing a lot of very interesting innovative technology coming out of China, a lot in the cell therapy space, a lot in the ADC space. And I do think that they are doing it more efficiently over there. And we're probably going to see more companies succeed in the global markets that originate in China.
Great. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And we hope you have a good weekend. We'll see you next week on Biotech Hangout. Thank you, everyone.